You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And this week's Deep Dive segment is called Falling on Your Sword, The Last Gasps of Privacy. And it's based off of an article I wrote in late June of last year, and just regarding privacy in general, which is a serious, serious topic. And it almost feels like we've lived through a golden age of privacy protections. And much like the exegesis of past historical events, we can sit and reflect on what was and what will be. If America has stood for one thing throughout its entire history, it's that individual rights and privacy is paramount. We have entire sections of our governing documents literally devoted to this. Now, previously, I've wrote an article and spoke about the many ways we as a people are tracked, monitored, and scrutinized for the purposes of government surveillance, corporate analytics, for advertising purposes, and other reasons. It was shocking to write that original article, as a few examples I knew off the top of my head morphed into multiple topics, and I was just beginning to find the rabbit hole at that point. I could have filled 5 articles with the information I found, but I'm not here to talk about a continuation of that. Rather, our government has been changing or removing rules and laws that help protect our privacy, and we're going to dive into that topic here today. So let's get to that. So let me lay some groundwork here before we dive in. In October 2016, the FCC adopted new rules for consumer privacy protections that safeguarded the internet users from their internet service providers' data collection tendencies. The quote-unquote sensitive data that would have enhanced protections included things like the user's precise geolocation, health information, which was already protected under HIPAA, but this was a extra layer, information on our children, web browsing history, financial data, and some other items. This was a huge step in October of 2016 in the right direction, especially for the administration. This is the Obama administration that hired former Comcast lobbyist Tom Wheeler to run the FCC, and a move that many equated with letting the fox guard the hen house. And when he was appointed to that, a lot of people had problems with this, figuring that Tom Wheeler was just a shill for Comcast, when in fact he actually really supported privacy laws. It was rather quite surprising to those of us that watch this constantly. Now, fast forward to March of 2017. The new administration is not a fan of regulation. One of the first things up on the chopping block was these new FCC privacy protection rules, which would effectively roll back our consumer protections overall. The Senate voted 50-48 along party lines to repeal this law and revoke these consumer protections. And FCC Mignon Clyburn, at the time, this is the commissioner before Ajit Pai took over, basically said, "If signed by the president, this law would repeal the FCC's widely supported broadband privacy framework and eliminate the requirement that cable and broadband providers offer customers a choice before selling their sensitive and personal information." This was actually said by FCC commissioner and FTC, that's a Federal Trade Commission commissioner, Terrell McSweeney, in a joint statement. Basically, in a nutshell, the U.S. Senate just voted a few months ago for less individual privacy in favor of corporate data collection. Now, the U.S. Congress is in the same vein. And not to be outdone by their counterparts, they voted to adopt what the Senate started, and with a vote of 215-205, repealed the FCC privacy regulations. Many members of Congress who opposed this repeal expressed a belief that their opposition colleagues didn't fully understand how our internet service providers collect data or how they could use it. Basically, the people that voted for this might have been those people that really don't understand how the internet works, how data collection works. We have a lot of Congress people that are aging, that are from an era where the internet really didn't exist. They didn't grow up with it or have it integrated like many of us out there, even beyond millennials. I mean, just as a Gen Xer, or I guess a Zennial, some people call it, but I definitely identify Gen X. I mean, we grew up in the infancy with this in our, you know, late youth, early teens to late teens. And so we have a lot of Congress people that just didn't have this. They simply saw these rules as pointless and that they wouldn't impact a user's ability to do whatever they wanted online, which is true. These rules do not impact you from going to wherever you want to go, including naughtyadultsite.com, but now your internet service provider, because of the Congress and Senate voting down these rules, can basically track this, record this for advertising and analytics purposes. And now that both houses have ratified the appeal, the FCC laws were removed, and fortunately, the public outcry was immediate. I mean, if you asked any random stranger on the street if they'd be okay with their personal data being collected and sold to third parties, the answer would most likely be a resounding no. In fact, I can't think of anybody, and I will challenge any one of my listeners here or anybody that follows me on Facebook and Twitter, if I asked you if you would be okay with your personal data being collected and sold to third parties, all your internet habits, everything, would you actually be okay with that? Would any of you actually answer yes? I highly doubt that. I really do, because it's such a personal thing, and what you do online is private to you. And okay, so here are the ramifications of less privacy, and I call this slouching towards 1984. You know, we are not turning into North Korea anytime soon, for the record. However, we are moving in their direction in some ways. Now, hear me out. At the most basic level, allowing any kind of entity, government, or otherwise, that does not require permission to collect data should be considered a violation of privacy and individual rights. This collected information is unknown to the person and can be used for virtually any purpose, including against that purpose. Now, think through a worst-case scenario here. Assume a user has an interest that is not illegal, but is still taboo. This user can now have this information, thanks to his or her browsing history, as recorded by the internet service provider. I'm not talking about the local browser history. They can have this information sold to other entities for advertising purposes, or possibly to the government for practically any reason, including evidence against that person. Now, if you think about it in this respect, the ISPs may have just become potentially a gaggle of J. Edgar Hoovers with damning information to sell to the highest bidder. That is a terrifying prospect. And if we're continuing the worst case scenario here, imagine their ISP, like imagine your ISP, for example, your internet service provider, holding this information over your head when you're late and paying a monthly bill. Now, that is obviously an extreme case, and I can't imagine they would do that. The outcry would be nuts, but this is the potential they have. Oh, you like something that is kind of outside of the norm or taboo, well, you know, you better pay your bill or this may become public. I mean, that's blackmail at its worst. You know, and if we keep removing laws that govern our privacy or ensure our privacy, who's to say that that's not the slippery slope that we eventually end up on? And I'm not sitting here talking about a logical fallacy, but, you know, one of the many different possibilities when we lose our privacy rights. And so if we do not have a government that focuses on privacy, then it's up to us to defend privacy ourselves. Now, here's a few steps that we can do this, and I'd like to call this fighting the man from the comfort of your own home. And the first thing that you can do is use a VPN service. And I've talked about VPNs before. I mean, they're so easy to set up. They charge about, you know, $30 to $50 a year. They'll work with Windows, Mac, you know, iPhone, iPad, Android. They're all very seamlessly. And if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it's basically a virtual private network that protects your internet browsing by encrypting it and routing through the VPN service. So basically, if all Comcast or AT&T, Verizon, etc. can see as a single connection to a VPN and can't access it because it's encrypted, then they have no idea what you're doing online and therefore cannot collect data on you. Now, I run one on every single device I own, and like I said, most single cost plans are $30 to $50 a year, and they'll allow you to secure 5 or 10 devices per single account. The one I use, I want to say like $40 a year, $50 a year, and I can do 5 simultaneous devices on it, which, you know, works for me rather well. So I can secure in real time my phone, my laptop, my computer, my, you know, tablet, that kind of stuff. Now, A couple of points, though, on a VPN when you get this. So some sites such as Netflix do not allow connections that come through VPNs. And so the VPN would have to be connected if you wanted to watch, you know, Netflix. But 99.9999% of all sites don't care. And so you're pretty much good everywhere else. And just one side note, I would definitely make sure that the VPN service you're running is using AES 256-bit encryption or higher, as it's more aggressive online. So using a VPN service is something that you can absolutely do, you know, that's cheap, easy to set up, and it will protect your privacy from the new FCC rollback and regulations. Now, the second thing you can do, and I think a lot of people that I know, especially just going through social media and seeing all this, is people need to limit their public information. Now, this one's rather easy to do if you think about it. I mean, don't publish deeply personal information online. I don't know how many times I've read things on Facebook that would fall under private information record-keeping laws like HIPAA for medical records. And while I understand that we all have our own concepts of what we do and do not consider private, and that some of us use our social media as basically a personal support / therapy group, we still need to see the forest from the trees here. This information can and will be collected for marketing and advertising purposes and can be subpoenaed for court. It's not just that your friends can see this information, it's potentially the world. And I mean, there's a saying that says, oh, when you post something on Facebook, you see it, your friends see it, and so does Facebook. And that's the truth. I mean, that's how they run analytics on you for advanced advertising. So, you know, if you're sitting there talking about, oh, I don't know, a specific kind of card like Ford cars, for example, you're going to start getting advertisement for Ford cars. That is not unusual. We also know that Google and Facebook and all that in their apps on their mobile devices will turn on the mic and listen to record for things. And there's specific apps, and I've talked about that before as well. It's up to each of us to safeguard our data as well as those we are obligated to protect, such as our children. You know, I've had more than one conversation where multiple participants agree that, you know, that we're all beyond lucky to go through high school without social media because none of the stupid teenage things we did was recorded. And now if that's not telling, I'm not sure what is. And we live in an age and a platform where we've got teenage kids putting all their stupid teenage high school things on Facebook, trying to make money or whatever. I mean, this is the Tide Pod Challenge and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, that comes back to haunt you. And that is the problem. So limiting your public information is something that you can absolutely do. Now, the third big thing you can do is actually limit cloud providers from tracking you. So a VPN is great for keeping your internet service provider at bay. However, companies like Google, who have ecosystems within their software for tracking, are also a threat to maintaining privacy. So for example, if you use Google Chrome, as most of us do now, it's the largest browser on the planet, and you're logging into your browser with your Google account, this allows Google to track you, your search history, your browsing habits, and many other data points. So while, let's say, your VPN is preventing Verizon or Comcast from actually reading your information, Google now has all of it because you're routing through their ecosystem and your VPN. Now, this is called being in their search bubble or quote-unquote filter bubble. And being in the bubble means that Google is custom tailoring the search results to you based on your history, which can then skew your results. We can combat this by using web browsers we do not need to log into and using search engines that do not track you. So, with all the privacy issues in Congress lately that I just talked about with the FCC, DuckDuckGo, a search engine that doesn't track you, has absolutely exploded in popularity. Again, that search engine is DuckDuckGo. If you go ahead and Google DuckDuckGo, you'll get that. And then you can use them as a search engine instead of Google, and that will get you out of their search and filter bubble. Now, because the results are out of this said filter bubble, the results may not seem as concise as Google. However, the results are significantly more unbiased, and they're not recorded in the same way that Google does. Another one of these is StartPage. It's one word, StartPage. And they claim total privacy, even taking it one step further, by letting users connect to the actual links via a proxy server, which gives you anonymity. Now, you don't need the proxy server if you're running your VPN full time. And so you can go to StartPage and just click the link and your VPN will actually mask that for you. But StartPage is another one that doesn't track you in the same way that Google will. So it's important to understand what privacy rights we have, but also important to understand how our information can be used and by whom. By keeping current on the issues and limiting public information, anyone can maintain a much smaller data footprint while still using technology. We all don't have to move to, you know, one-room shacks in Montana and start writing manifestos here. We just have to maintain some vigilance. Now, ultimately, we should be able to use technology comfortably without letting the technology use us. The hope for the future is that as we begin to elect representatives who are savvy enough to know that the internet is not just a quote-unquote series of tubes, if you remember Alaska Senator Ted Stevens saying that, who was incredibly old, and probably this is how his staff, you know, his young staff decided to equate the internet to him so he could actually understand it. You know, so if we're savvy enough to know that the internet is not just a series of tubes and how information can be collected, our privacy rights should be rebounding in the right direction, because it's on us. And hopefully those rights won't have been eroded too badly by the time we actually get on that wagon. So just maintaining a little bit of vigilance goes a long way in your life. And hopefully you'll take these steps and you will become private, because right now, as it stands, we've got the Comcasts, the Verizons, the Googles of the world tracking literally our every move. And it's up to us to make sure that we don't let them track. And this has been your Deep Dive on the Deep Dive Radio Show. You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And this deep dive is called Stopping the Signal. Is it possible to shut down WikiLeaks? And this is based off of an article I wrote a while back. So at this point, I think everybody, even people living in caves, know what WikiLeaks is. Good or bad, the information contained in WikiLeaks sheds light on the inner workings of both governments and corporations alike. Recently, it was proposed that certain parts of the internet be shut down to combat ISIS and its cyber terrorism recruitment campaign. Now, this was said by then-candidate Donald Trump prior to the election in order to shut down sections of the internet, as I just said, to combat things like cyber terrorism. And then eventually it, you know, evolved into the whole Russian hacking thing. And then he flipped to use the WikiLeaks to say, hey, you know, Russia, why don't you hack Hillary's email server and all that kind of stuff. So while the full extent of Trump's remark was unclear, the notion of shutting down parts of the internet to prevent access from a group like ISIS has been universally scoffed at by cybersecurity and infrastructure experts worldwide, definitely including myself. This did, however, raise many questions by those wanting to understand why shutting off parts of the internet is not possible. And recently, this question was renewed when the Ecuadorian embassy cut off Julian Assange's internet access, effectively making him blind to the world and unable to update WikiLeaks or communicate with others. And if you're unfamiliar with Julian Assange, he's the one that actually founded WikiLeaks. And he has been hunted by Interpol, and then he was up on charges in his home country. I believe it was Sweden or possibly Norway. And so he escaped to the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he's been living for the last 5 years. So in this deep dive segment, we're going to explore why it's virtually impossible in the age of the internet to cut off a site like WikiLeaks, as well as look at cyber warfare methods that attempt to do this for strategic and disruptive purposes. So we're going to dive into how a government entity could wage a cyber warfare campaign against WikiLeaks to shut down or stop the flow of information. And so to understand why this is virtually impossible is to understand how communication spreads agnostically to the machinations of others, as well as how the internet is structured. Now, over the centuries, governments and organizations have tried to suppress and control information, usually only to achieve failure. Literature has survived book burnings, inquisitions, and even genocides. Now, when there's a dedicated group of people working towards the preservation of ideas, it is impossible to stop. But as we're going to discuss later, it is possible to slow down the dissemination of information. And given that the internet moves data rapidly across the globe, it's about 3,000 miles a second through a loosely confederated network of servers, routers, internet service providers, shutting down parts of it is feasible, but it cannot stop information from moving around the outage. So if we're looking at like some of the more recent distributed denial of service attacks against major providers, we've been seeing the largest types of these kinds of attacks in history outages to the internet have occurred but did not bring the entire internet grid down, if you will. So if you look at it, we had a major attack with an infection called Mirai that knocked out probably, I think it was maybe 50% of Starbucks and Netflix and a couple of others. So half the country couldn't get into Starbucks while the other half was just fine. That meant Starbucks was still alive, even if it was hindered. Same with Netflix. So, and this is why WikiLeaks can withstand the onslaught of an attack. Their organization has anonymous members worldwide that safeguard copies of the data, both online and offline. So you can knock out the WikiLeaks website or their domain or their current host, and its members can bring online a new website with a new domain and republish everything very quickly. Ransomware hackers work in a similar manner in that they're globally spread out to avoid detection, and then they rotate their websites constantly. WikiLeaks tries to maintain the same site, but can and will change if they need to remain a moving target, and they've been incredibly effective at doing this over the years. It's also for this reason that stopping ISIS, for example, by shutting down parts of the internet is essentially a fool's errand. They have supporters and operatives in several regions that would not be affected by a localized outage. And if authorities can't identify these people, then how do you combat something like this? So welcome to Cyber Warfare 101. And if we're fighting the future war, at the most basic level of warfare, rendering your enemy deaf and blind is paramount. If you can create a situation where they cannot gather information, disseminate it to their troops, or even communicate, then the attacker has a distinct advantage. In technology, it's no different, and every major government is continuously developing new ways to accomplish this over the internet. Because the internet is so critical to our economy and infrastructure, shutting it down means shutting down much of our commerce and our government workings. Everything would grind to a halt, and an inability to contact the authorities could cause people to panic. So recently I wrote about, and I've spoken on here on the Deep Dive Radio Show, where I've discussed an attack on Ukraine's power grid that was so complete that the hackers even hit the phone system so nobody could call to complain. They literally made an entire region of the Ukraine, and we now know that it was basically Russian operatives in the buildup to the Crimea invasion. They basically shut down power and then tied up the phone system. So an entire population in a region of Ukraine was deaf and blind. So these cyber attacks are directed against fixed targets that can easily be probed and analyzed. So how does this relate to something like WikiLeaks that is small and a moving target within global support? It's relevant because a government doesn't necessarily need to make the WikiLeaks organization deaf and blind worldwide. It just has to temporarily do so in an attempt to slow down the viral nature of information WikiLeaks disseminates. So consider that to fully stop WikiLeaks, even temporarily, all of their websites and domains would have to be cut. Their social media platforms would have to be stopped as well, not to mention identifying WikiLeaks as quote-unquote employees and cutting them off from all forms of internet. This doesn't include individuals who have manually downloaded copies of their data to their local computers and servers for their own reason, and pretty much anybody can go and download WikiLeaks. It's not that hard to do, and so there's probably a lot of people out there that have done that, that have no affiliation with WikiLeaks. They just want to read the data offline or back it up or whatever it is. And so understanding the sheer impossibility of that first step towards grasping the complexity of the situation is of paramount importance. So what's a government cyber warfare division to do when you don't have a single easy target to hit? Quite a bit, actually. They can do quite a bit. And here are some major ways that WikiLeaks can be damaged or even temporarily knocked out without having to publicly shut down or try to create international laws to stop them. So if I'm running the cyber warfare division for a major government intelligence agency, these are some things that I can achieve to make sure that WikiLeaks is down or offline. So the first thing I can do is we can infiltrate the inner workings of the WikiLeaks organization and attempt to infect multiple WikiLeaks users for the purpose of gathering intelligence or spreading the infection throughout the organization. So if I'm able to identify WikiLeaks users, get an infection on there, then I can possibly start reading what they're doing, mapping out their network, all that kind of stuff. Secondarily, I could plant false information into WikiLeaks by pretending to be a whistleblower with very sensitive information. Now, this information could put a spotlight on WikiLeaks, and once the data is publicly discredited, I could harm WikiLeaks' reputation. And this is what a lot of people have accused Russia of. And we know that they bought several ads on, you know, Facebook and other social media platforms to sow dissemination, to discredit, let's say, one candidate over another in the presidential election, or also to steer public in one way or the other. Because if you have a legitimate looking news site and you are reporting news that, let's say, is hyperbole or misinformed or just flat out wrong, you have the ability to sway a segment of the population that might be inclined to believe it based on either, you know, their set of values, their political stance, or maybe they're just not critically thinking. And that's what we can do to WikiLeaks. If I am running a government intelligence agency, I can plant false information into WikiLeaks. I could also, and this is my third option, release false or infected information claiming to be from WikiLeaks in an attempt to obfuscate the truth while making WikiLeaks seem unsafe to view. So in other words, I could start infecting users that would typically be going to WikiLeaks, possibly by hijacking WikiLeaks or through some other infection campaign, and then people would start to distrust WikiLeaks. Well, if I go to WikiLeaks, I'm going to get infected. That is kind of the goal there. A fourth option would be to break into WikiLeaks' deep web websites used by the whistleblowers to monitor or even intercept the data before WikiLeaks, before it reaches WikiLeaks itself. And so one of the ways that you can submit data to WikiLeaks is through the dark web, and it is considered like a secure portal. If I am able to discover that and crack that, I might be able to stop the flow of information, capture the data as it's going on, identify the whistleblowers for either arrest or, you know, publicly exposed, which would then discredit WikiLeaks, because no whistleblower is going to want to get caught, obviously, especially if they've got very damning information and they might be under threat if they do release it. And thank you so much for tuning in this week. It was another fun show, and I think we covered a lot of really good stuff, and I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. It was a really good time, and I hope you keep tuning in. Thank you very much for listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show here with Nick Espinoza. And if you have any comments, suggestions, questions, absolutely anything, once again, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. And you can always send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. Don't be shy. I love the feedback. We've been having a great time with the show. And as always, stay safe and stay online, everyone. Thanks for listening.